You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
There we go. So, question, who just sang that song? Yeah? Who? You did? Who sang it? Who sang the song? Who is the author? Toby Keith, who sang that version? Jelly Roll, yeah, so there you go. So question for you, like if I am in this kind of garb and I'm in the Old West and I'm about to rob a bank and I pull out my pink Nerf gun, because this is the only one that had a holster. Ooh. You can pull me back just for a little bit because this is like shoved in my face and then you'll have to lift me back up there. And it's kind of hard to breathe, so if I pass out when I'm robbing a bank, but I pull out this, right? And what is the classic Old West line? If the gun is pointed at you, they're robbing the bank, they say what? Stick them up, right? Because they also call this, they say what? This is a stick up, right? What does stick them up mean? Like, do it, ready? Stick them up. Do it, right? All right, so when you do that, right? Why do we do that? Surrender, okay, what else? Anything else? Show that you don't have anything, all right, yeah? Any other thoughts? I mean, those are right. So the idea is you say stick them up because it's an act of surrender, of submission, saying like, I got nothing. I'm safe. I'm obeying. I'm doing what you say. You know, and we do that naturally kind of now, I guess, without even saying stick them up. If, you know, somebody shows up with a gun, not that this normally happens to you. And this is like mashing my nose. If they say, you know, sort of like, hey, I'm unarmed, it's okay. Even if you're like in a fight, maybe you've gotten to that spot with your spouse where it's like you're having a verbal argument, like, hey, I surrender. Like, I give up, I submit. I'm not a threat. And that idea is something we're going to talk about today. If I don't pass out from this thing. Seriously, like, bank robbers. I don't know how, and maybe it's because I don't have hair to like hold it on my head, but this thing kept slipping down. But this idea of surrender is something, again, you can pull me back again, Isaac, because I didn't do a sound check like I was supposed to. So the idea of surrender and submission is something that we're going to look at today. And we're continuing this series called Through the Eyes of John. And as we saw last week, we're looking at John, his perspective from the Gospel of John, which, by the way, I didn't say this. The Gospel of John is one book that John wrote, and John also wrote, ready for this? 1 John, and then 2 John, and 3 John. Yep, I know. What? And you were like, I thought that was Peter. No, guess what Peter wrote? 1 Peter. Yep, and 2 Peter. But anyway, John wrote the Gospel of John, but also 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Revelation. And so he recorded all of those things for us. But we're specifically looking at the Gospel of John because as we saw last week, and I'm not going to get into it because we talked about it at length, but there are four gospel views of Jesus, four different authors writing for four different perspectives. And Matthew, Mark, Luke are called that. Does anybody remember? They mean same eyes, same look. Synoptics, yeah, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the synoptics because they kind of have the same perspective. But John's gospel is a little bit different. Because he actually wrote his gospel at the end of his life, reflecting back on all the things that Jesus did. And so we're going to talk more about this idea of surrender. But we're also going to talk about the point for this week as we look at things through John's eyes, is that you're going to see that John saw that Jesus planned to die. By the way, I actually brought the harmony of the Gospels. I mentioned this last week. If you were here last week and you're like, hey, I want to look at that, it's here. You can come and talk to me afterwards. But John saw that Jesus planned to die. And one of the things that we saw last week, even as we... Whew, sorry, it's a little sweaty in here.
this is not mine. I want to be a cowboy, but I'm not really. But one of the things that we saw last week is we looked at the story of the Last Supper and Judas betraying Jesus. And again, you can find that on our website, mc3church.org. Click on Listen to the Point. But we saw last week that Judas betrayed Jesus. And we knew that because we know the story. But for John, that was a perspective that was like, wait, what? And this phrase, Jesus planned to die, you're probably like, well, duh. I mean, that's coming up this Friday. We call it Good Friday. Jesus died. People that don't even believe in Jesus, don't even like Jesus, kind of know, yeah, Jesus died. Like, that's a normal thing. But as we're going to see this morning, that's not exactly the case. So what I'm going to do here is before we even get into that, so like before we talk about surrender and before we talk about John's perspective, I want to talk about something else because I'm trying to cram as much as possible in this time so that you'll get out of here easily by 2 o'clock. But I want to talk about crucifixion and specifically like what, well, yeah, just the whole idea of crucifixion. And all right, this is a wool thing that's not going to work for me right now. But I want to talk about crucifixion because I think we kind of know a little bit about it, but do we really know what it is? And so I want to just kind of answer some questions and share some thoughts about what crucifixion is, how it worked. And so the first thing here is, what is crucifixion? And I actually did a lot of research this week. I read a whole book for you guys. I had a book that I got for Christmas a couple years ago. It was written in German and then translated to English. And so it was a fun read. But it was all about the history of crucifixion in the time of Jesus. And like, what was it? And the one thing that we discovered is that, or this guy discovered, is that most people didn't talk about it because it was so barbaric that it was almost offensive to even write about it. And ironically, the best history that we have of crucifixion is found in the Gospels. That is actually one of the main resources. Even for people who don't believe in the Bible or believe Jesus, historians use the Gospels as a way to determine things about crucifixion. But this article or this book said that there were a couple of things. Number one, it was intended to be barbaric. It was meant to be something that was just violent, just awful, just painful. The second thing about it is that it was, I said it was painful. And it was meant to produce maximum pain and, get this, minimal death. They didn't want you to die because if you died, the pain's over. So crucifixion was designed as a way to create maximum pain, minimal death. Eventually, death was the goal, but it didn't happen right away. At least that was the goal of a good crucifixion. And then finally, it was humiliating. It was designed to be completely humiliating for the person that was crucified. And I actually I came across an article a few years ago. It was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and there were three or four doctors. I don't remember how many there were. In the 80s. They actually did a study, not necessarily believing who Jesus was or not even Christ followers, but they're like, what are the scientific medical aspects of crucifixion? And it's an incredible read as they look at how this worked and why someone died from crucifixion and all the pieces of it. But crucifixion, for the most part, was perfected, if you will, by the Romans. And the Romans were the empire. They were in charge during Jesus' time. And we don't have time to get into all this, but basically Rome came through before Jesus was even born and conquered basically the known world. And so Israel was subject to Rome. And the Roman leader was called the emperor. He was the Caesar. Named after the first emperor, Julius Caesar. And so they were the ones in charge, and so they were responsible for capital punishment throughout the world, throughout the known world, and they were also the ones that had to give permission for capital punishment, for crucifixion. But it always started with a beating. And the way the beating worked, and I don't want to take too much time here, but the role or the goal of the beating was to give the torturer as much latitude as they wanted. And the goal was to get them in as much pain so that they didn't die, because you didn't want them to die quickly. And the way it would work is the person was stripped naked, And they were placed over a pole. And actually, The Passion of the Christ did a great job, that movie, a couple decades ago, portraying it violently, gruesomely, because it was. But they would have a whip that had leather, like, pieces that stuck out, and they would tie they would tie in pieces of metal, and it was they intentionally stood to the side of the person that was being beaten, and they would beat them from the side, and the thing would wrap all the way around, and then those pieces of metal or bone would get caught in the flesh and rip it back. And then they would switch and go to the other side and go back and forth. And there was no real rule in Rome. The Jewish law required that no one could ever be beaten more than 40 times. And Jews were so worried about this that they actually did. You probably might have heard this phrase, 40 lashes minus one. And Paul actually refers to it in, I believe it was in Acts. Because they didn't want to cross that line, so they always stopped at 39, just in case they miscounted. But the Romans had no rule like that. And so they would beat the person and just rip the flesh apart. Their back would be shredded. And it was extremely painful. And then they would take the person, and as far as the official rule, is they would give them the cross. And it wasn't the whole cross, but it was the cross beam that would go on the cross. And they would have to carry it to the place of execution. And this was all part of the humiliation process. And they had to carry it on their back or their shoulders. And it was about 200 and some pounds, very heavy, which, by the way, says a side note that Jesus had a horrible beating, and there were some other things that they did when they were physically beating him when they dressed him up as a king and said, "Hail, King of the Jews." That's not even part of the official thing, but he survived. Like he wasn't a weakling, he wasn't a frail old man. He was a strong, early 30s guy, and so they would make you carry the cross beam of the cross to the place of execution. And that was meant on purpose. And it was through a very prominent public place so that everyone would see you and they would jeer you, spit at you, throw rocks at you, whatever, because it was all fair game because you were being crucified. And there's a reason, we'll get to that in a moment, why you were crucified, and you deserve what you're getting. And so they would have to carry this heavy bar some say it was probably a 1.5 miles that Jesus had to carry this from the initial place to the place of crucifixion, which we'll get to in a second also. But they would have to carry it. And obviously in the story of the Gospels, we see that Jesus couldn't even carry it that far. He was a little weakened. So Simon had to pick up the cross and carry it for him. But their back, by the way, don't forget, is shredded. And so then they would get to the cross, and the cross beam was placed across the cross. And on the vertical, which is called the stipes, and you don't need to know all that, but the horizontal was placed on the vertical, and they would strip the person naked. Like, a loincloth is being polite. That's not what happened. They were completely naked, completely humiliated, and then they would be laid, remember their shredded back, on a rough chunk of lumber. So you're like, oh, I got a splinter. Okay, think about that with a shredded, completely open back. And they would place them, the person that was being crucified there, and they would put their hands out over the thing. They did not stretch them completely. They kept them inside a little bit. And actually, it was a spike, usually a 6-inch to 8-inch spike, was driven right through here. Even though Jesus said, "See my hands," and they were talking about the holes in his hands, the Jews considered all of this your hand. And it went through there and on the other side. It went all the way through, holding you to the cross. And then they would put your feet on top of each other, and then they would bend your knees slightly, and this is a big deal. They would bend your knees slightly so that your feet could be flat, and then they would stick one nail through the center of your both feet, holding it in. It was gruesome, it was violent, it was painful. And again, this journal, the Medical Association study, talked about all the nerves that are right there and how just the pain of that spike. And so they'd be put that way, and then again, now your back is rubbing against all this. It's a horrible thing. They would lift up the cross, and most of the time there was a hole that they would drop the cross in. And when that would happen, it would either dislocate your shoulders, or just they would hang there. And the way this is why crucifixion was so awful, is that people rarely, they didn't want someone to die from exhaustion or in terms of the beating or blood loss. They typically died technically from exhaustion, but they died because they couldn't breathe. And here's the thing. I want you to do something for me. I'm going to count to three, and I want you to breathe in and then breathe out, okay? On three. One, two, three. Okay. Now, when you breathe in, your rib cage and your lungs open up. That's how you breathe in. And to breathe out, I mean, it's like a bellows. You know, you breathe out, you compress that. Well, because of the way their arms were hung on the cross, they could breathe in forever. Their lungs were expanded. But the problem was that they couldn't breathe out. And so, and I'm not going to get all the technical stuff about the carbon dioxide buildup in your blood, but the way the crucified person would breathe out is that they would have to pull up against the painful nerves in their hands, pull up, and push up against their feet because nothing was stretched straight. They had to use that, scraping their back along the cross to simply breathe out. And then they would release. An interesting side note, when you speak, you breathe out because no one can speak like that. Because no one can speak breathing in. And so Jesus actually said seven different things from the cross. And you got to think, he is actually saying those things while pulling against these nails. And so that's how they would breathe as they were there. Because their shoulders were dislocated. They couldn't just breathe out. Everything was being pulled open. So they had to push up against the nails in their hands and their feet so that they could exhale. And then they get a moment of rest. And then have to do that again and again and again until they gave up and died. And if you remember, I just lost my screen. Okay. And if you remember the story in the Gospels, it was time for, they said that it was getting close to sundown because Jewish law didn't permit someone to stay on the cross. So Jewish crucifixions, they would go and what do they do to the legs? Anybody remember? They break. They would break the legs of the people hanging on the cross. Why did they break the legs of the people hanging on the cross? Because it sped up death. Because if you did not have your feet to push up against, it was just their hands, and they would die a lot faster. Now, they got to Jesus, and they didn't need to break his legs because he was already dead. But that was crucifixion in a nutshell. It was not a pleasant thing. And it was meant, again, to be painful, to be humiliating. And this is what Jesus did. Spoiler. For you and me. And so that's what crucifixion was. So the next thing is, why were they crucified? Again, we already talked about public humiliation. It was meant to be completely and utterly humiliating. And I mean, I think right now, if I grabbed one of you, which I would not do this, if this gets cut out on the live stream, please help me out. Do not, no lawsuits. But if I were to grab one of you up, bring you up here, and force you to strip naked in front of everybody, just that would be humiliating. And that was just the beginning of the humiliation of the cross. And so it was to be humiliation. It was also meant as a warning. And that was the big deal about crucifixion. Because it was so public. It was meant as a warning for everybody else. You see that guy there? If you do what he did, that's going to happen to you. And so it was a really good way to keep people from doing the bad things. And actually, before crucifixion was perfected by the Romans, and we even see this in the Old Testament, a number of times someone that was already dead, was already killed, would be placed up on a pole. We see that in the story of Esther with Haman, and you can read that story in the Bible. If you look at the story of David and Goliath, Goliath's head spent a lot of time in a lot of different places because it was meant as a symbol of the destruction, of the conquering. It was like, don't let that become an issue. So dead people were placed on poles a lot of times before they crucified. And typically, and this is again adding to the humiliation and the degradation, is that bodies were never allowed to be taken down. For the most part, the body would stay there until maggots and birds and whatever else, whether they were alive or dead, because birds would also start pecking at you and all that, and they couldn't stop you. You couldn't stop them if you're on the cross. But they were left there until they just kind of disintegrated and fell off because it was that humiliating. They didn't even get a decent burial. Now, Romans allowed burial with permission. And so that's why Joseph of Arimathea was able. He was a man of standing. So he went to the Roman authorities. Again, I'm just telling you some of the gospel story. Why was he able to get Jesus' body? Because he was a man of standing. He was an authority person. And they're like, okay, we'll give this to you. The law allows that. So it allowed them to bury the body. So that's why people were crucified. Where were they crucified? Typically, as I said, it was on a very public place. It was usually on a main road. There's been stories of Romans where there was an uprising, and we'll talk about uprisings in a moment, where, there was an uprising, and there were 3,000 people that were crucified, and they replaced all of their bodies along the main road into the city. So that as you're walking by all 3,000 of these dead people, it's a reminder, yeah, don't don't do that. It was in a very public place on the main road. They say that almost every major city had a Golgotha-like place. Golgotha was called the place of the skull, and that was the Greek word was Golgotha, which meant place of the skull, not because it had skulls, but it looked like skulls. And the Latin word, which is kind of weird when you think about this, the Latin word for Golgotha or place of the skull is Calvary. And we're like, we don't be like, yeah, Skull Hill. You know, we name our churches after Skull Hill, and we sing songs about on Skull Hill. But that's actually what it means. And so there was every city had a Golgotha-like place where there was a very public. And so Golgotha wasn't like some hill down by the river in the corner. It was a very public place where they say most people could see it from wherever they were in the city of Jerusalem to see this public place because they wanted it to be humiliating and they wanted people to see it. And then finally, who was crucified? First of all, only non-Romans. A Roman would not get crucified. And there's a little incident with Paul in the book of Acts where they're getting ready to beat him. And he's like, hey, I'm a Roman citizen. And suddenly they're like, whoa, wait, what? Why did you tell us this? Because you could get in a lot of trouble with Rome if a Roman citizen was crucified. But typically, it was mostly Roman slaves. Because there were lots of them, and slavery in the Roman era was not like what we consider in, pre-Civil War America slavery. Most people placed themselves into slavery, into servanthood, most of the time, not all the time, because that's how they paid their bills. That was kind of their job, if you will. And by the way, we spent a whole lot of time talking about it in our Crops 2 series. You can find that. It's not on the slide. But it was typically the slaves because there were a lot of them because they had to keep them in submission because if the slaves rose up against Rome, then like Rome would lose because they were way outnumbered. The other thing that was typically was that it was rebels and robbers. Most other people did not get crucified. If you did a bad thing, even murder wasn't as big of a deal as if you were rebelling against Rome. Or if you were a thief, because they had what is called Pax Romana. Rome came in and said, we are going to make it good for you to live as a part of the Roman Empire, and we will make sure there's peace. And they did a pretty good job, but they didn't bring peace because of kindness. They brought peace because of oppression. And so if you were a thief, you were more likely to be crucified, the highest form of torture and punishment, than if you were a murderer. And so also if you rebelled against the government. And so you think about it, why was Jesus crucified? Not because he claimed to be God, because the Romans didn't care about that. Remember, Pilate didn't care about that. And neither did Herod wasn't necessarily part of that statement. But they didn't care about that. What they cared about was that he claimed to be king. And that meant he was going against the emperor. And that's why the Romans were like, okay, fine. You can crucify him because he's claiming to be better than the emperor. And then, of course, he was crucified next to two thieves, right? And so that's why they were there. So a lot of that was the kind of the history of crucifixion. It was an awful, awful thing, which brings us to our story and the point, which was that John saw that Jesus planned to die. So we're going to turn on the house lights here. We're actually going to be in John chapter. Oh, I lost you. Anybody else losing stuff here? I'm losing stuff. We're going to be in John chapter 19. So you can open YouVersion to John 19. And we're just going to share, there's a final request here. Is this passage that we find in John 13. And again, Gospel of John saw things differently. So there are some things that John recorded that the other three Gospels didn't record. And so in this final request scene, we see a couple things. First of all, we see four soldiers. In John 19, 23-24. And I just keep losing my notes here. All right. In John 19, 23, this is what it says. When the soldiers had crucified Jesus. So now all those things that we just discussed had already happened. We did a series called Spoiler Alert a number of years ago that's on the slideshow loop. You can find that where we talked through kind of all these parts to it. But they had crucified Jesus. They divided his clothes among the four of them. So there's four soldiers here that are with Jesus. And it says they also took his robe, but it was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said, rather than tearing it apart, let's throw dice for it. And John records that this fulfilled the scripture that says, they divided my garments among themselves and threw dice for my clothing. So that's what they did. And so you have this moment. Jesus is now crucified, nailed to the cross, and they take off his clothing. There's four soldiers there, and they're like, okay, well, you get this, you get that. Wait, this one's really nice. Okay, look, what we'll do is we'll throw dice, we'll cast lots, we're going to kind of see who gets this one, and then, you know, rock, paper, scissors, shoot. And that person gets to have the clothing. So there's four soldiers here, and it's interesting because John takes these four soldiers and kind of places them in his story up against the next part, which is four women. So you got four soldiers, and then you've got four women. And in John 19, yeah, I keep losing this thing here. I don't know what's up. I'll just have to use my notes. In John 19, verse 26, we see the next thing here with these four women. It says, standing near the cross were Jesus' mother and his... I'm going to read the whole thing, and then we'll come back to it. Jesus' mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So, looking at these four women that are at the cross, the other synoptic gospels talk about some different numbers and the different women and who they were. They think there were probably four that were there. And here's an interesting little side, not necessarily a side note, but just to try to track with me here. It says Jesus' mother. So that's woman number one. What's Jesus' mother's name? Mary. Okay, good. We're going to get confusing here in a moment. Then it says his mother's sister. So his mother's sister, we find out in the other Gospels that this is probably a woman named Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E. And it turns out that she is Mary's sister, but also the wife of Zebedee. Now, do you remember last week, who are the sons of Zebedee? John, right, and his brother James. And so this woman, this second woman, Salome, is Mary's sister-in-law, but also John's mom. So John's mom is there, and they often say, as we said last week about the disciple Jesus loved, how John never refers to himself in the third person. He doesn't refer to his own family that way either. He just says his mother's sister, Jesus' mother's sister. So Salome, which was his mom. And so it's Jesus' aunt on his mom's side. Then it says Mary, the wife of Clopas. So now we're on second Mary. Third woman, second Mary. Mary, the wife of Clopas. And we find out in other passages, as you read over, you find out that Clopas probably is Joseph, Jesus' dad, Jesus' earthly. It's probably Joseph's brother. So Mary is, try to track all this. Mary is Joseph's sister-in-law. There we go. Got that right. So second Mary is there, and she's the wife of Clopas. And then the third Mary is Mary Magdalene, and Magdalene is not her name. It was that she is Mary of Magdala. She is from Magdala. She is a Magdalene. And she was also, we find out that at one point Jesus cast seven demons out of her. And she was one of the women that followed Jesus from the early on. And actually, there was a whole group of women. You probably don't even see this. It's a very obscure passage in there. But there were a bunch of women that followed Jesus and gave them the money. Like, they bankrolled the disciples as they were following Jesus. And so that's Mary Magdalene. So you've got Mary, Salome, Mary, and Mary. And that just, you know, it's a little bit confusing. But let's talk about, as far as family, what you've got is Jesus' mom. You've got Jesus' aunt on his mom's side. You've got Jesus' aunt on his dad's side. And then Mary Magdalene, again, who was very early on in the following of Jesus. So you've got these four women that are there at the cross. And so you got John saying, here's these awful Roman soldiers, four of them, and these four women that are dear to Jesus, that are closely connected to him, mostly by family, and then again Mary Magdalene, because of just the relationship that she had with him. So you've got these four soldiers, four women, which leads to foreshadowing. Because we're foreshadowing something. But, first, a flashback. We're getting in the Wayback Machine, and we're going to go back a little bit because I want to talk about some things that matter before we get to this foreshadowing moment, before we get to this moment where we see John here. The first thing comes from Isaiah chapter 9, because in Jesus' time, all the Jewish people were looking forward to the one called the Christ, the Christos, or the Jewish word was, anybody remember? The Hebrew word Messiah, the Mashiach. They're looking forward to the Messiah, the anointed one that will come. And the Old Testament is full of these prophecies saying, one day someone's going to come to make it right. One day someone's going to make it right. One day it's all going to come. And Abraham was told, you know, all the world will be blessed through a descendant of yours. And David said, one of your descendants will sit on the throne and rule forever. And he is the Messiah, the Messiah, the Messiah. It's a big, big, big deal to the Jewish people. And in Isaiah chapter 9, one of the prophecies of the Messiah, which we went through this chapter, or this chapter 9, verse 6, in the God We Need series. It's on the slideshow loop. We did that at Christmas time. But look at these words. And these are what the Jewish people in Jesus' time, such as John, such as Matthew, Mark, and Luke, such as the disciples, are aware of. And Isaiah said this in verse 1. He says, nevertheless, that time of darkness and despair, because he's talking about things are rough. This is Isaiah. This is well before Jesus' time. That time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. The land of Zebulun and Naphtali will be humbled, but there will be a time in the future when Galilee of the Gentiles, which lies along the road that runs between the Jordan and the sea, will be filled with glory. Where did Jesus do his ministry? He walked by on the Sea of Galilee. Right. So now, okay, context, they're in this place. And it says, those people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Okay, things were rough, but something big is coming. A big light is coming. And those who live in a land of deep darkness, a light will shine. Listen to these phrases. You will enlarge the nation of Israel, this one that's coming, this light. He's going to enlarge the nation of Israel and its people will rejoice. How does one enlarge a nation? They conquer. They win. They get bigger. They buy Greenland. I don't know. But they get it. That's how you get bigger. Like, it's not just like, oh, and suddenly the map is going to change or the earth is going to shift. It's just saying, no, that someone is coming that's going to do that. He says, they will rejoice for you as people rejoice at the harvest. And like, what is the next word? Okay, what is the next word? On three. One, two, three. Warriors, right? Warriors. What do warriors do? They conquer, they fight, they win, right? And so, like warriors dividing the plunder, he goes on and says, for this person will break the yoke of their slavery. Do you know of anybody in the time of Jesus that is under the yoke of slavery? Is there an oppressor, perhaps, like Rome, that is controlling everyone that's Jewish? The answer is yes. So this one is going to break the yoke of slavery. He's going to lift a heavy burden from their shoulders. He's going to break the oppressor's rod. Just as you did. Now he's going to break the rod. He's going to break the control. How did he do it? When you destroyed the army of Midian. So this one is going to come. He's going to break the rod of oppression. And not by like, excuse me, can we not be under oppression now? No, it's going to be violent. It's going to be breaking like they destroyed the army of Midian. The boots of the warrior and the uniforms bloodstained by war will all be burned. Remember those people that came in and conquered with violence and bloodshed and just took out? They're all going to be burned. They will be fuel for the fire. It goes on and says, and you probably have heard this before, for a child is born to us, a son is given to us, someone is coming, and the government will rest on his shoulders. So this person is going to handle the government. They're going to be in charge. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And again, we did that last December. His government and its peace will never end. He will, what's the next word there? One, two, three. Rule. He's going to rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. And then Isaiah wraps up this little segment by saying, the passionate commitment of the Lord of Heaven's armies will make this happen. This is one of the prophecies of the Messiah that these Jewish people are looking for. And Jesus shows up on the scene and says, I am the Messiah. And so they're expecting victory. They're expecting domination. They're expecting war. They're expecting battle. Unfortunately, they missed some of the other prophecies, including in Isaiah 53. Like a sheep led to slaughter, he will not open his mouth. But nobody wants to think about that. Nobody even knows what that meant in their time. They're like, no, victory, victory, conquer, death, win, win, win. And so that is part one of the flashback in Isaiah 9, verse 1. The second verse from the flashback is now we're going a lot more into the present time is Matthew 16. And in Matthew 16, now we're in the Gospels. We're at the life of Jesus. We're with the disciples here. And there's this moment in Matthew 16, verse 21, where it says, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples. Listen to what he says. He says to them, he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, which were the trials he went through. And that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. Jesus says this to them. And we're like, well, yeah, we know the story. They didn't. They're waiting for a conquering Messiah. And Jesus says, I'm going to go and I'm going to die at the hands of all the people that we hate. And so what did Peter do? Being a good disciple, being a good follower of Jesus, a good understanding, a good Jew, saying, no, I know the law. I know the Messiah. And so Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. And this word rebuke in Greek is not a kind word. He's not like, hey, Jesus, can we, you know, maybe we shouldn't say that. Is that okay? This is like, Jesus, what are you saying? Don't know. If I hear that come out of your mouth again, boy, I'm going to, you better not. Like, this was a very strong term that he is rebuking Jesus. And he says, never, Lord, this will never happen to you. You shut up, Jesus, right now. Don't even, like, what do you think you're doing? You're the Messiah. Just shut it. When I want to hear something from you, I'll tell you what I can hear from you. Like, that's what's going on here. And what did Jesus say? He's like, wow, you said some really harsh words to me. What am I going to say back? Not that Jesus was getting back at him. But what did he say? Get behind me, Satan! Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he kind of won that conversation there. He says, get behind me, Satan. Why? Not because he was being mean to Peter, but because he said, you're a stumbling block to me. Why? You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Peter's thinking, conquer, win, beat Rome, in charge, throne, armies, yes, yes, yes. And Jesus is thinking, salvation for everyone. Rescue from sin. Rescue from hell. But let's be honest, that's not as exciting. Like, if there were newspapers in Jesus, I guess there probably were newspapers, maybe in Jesus' time, this would not be the headline they're talking about. That's boring. And so, as part of this foreshadowing, as part of this flashback here, you've got Peter and the other disciples agreeing, like, you should stop talking about this, Jesus, because that is not what a Messiah does. It's almost like, hey, be careful, we're going to unfollow you. So, Jesus might have been the first person to be canceled by Peter. So Isaiah 9, then Matthew 16, and then one more little piece of this flashback comes to Matthew 26, and now we're talking mere hours before the crucifixion. And so Jesus, this is right after what we read last week, right after the upper room, the Last Supper. They go out to the garden to pray, which we'll come back to that in a second. And now it says that they're in the garden, they're finished praying, and it says, so Judas came straight to Jesus. We know what Judas did, that was last week. Greetings, Rabbi, he exclaimed, and gave him the kiss, and the kiss was the term, the symbol for betraying him. And Jesus said, my friend, go ahead and do what you have come for. It says, then the others, the authorities, the Roman soldiers were there, grabbed Jesus and arrested him. But one of the men with Jesus, who we find out is Peter from one of the other Gospels, pulled out his sword and struck the high priest's slave. Because the high priest was there, he was in charge, struck the slave, cutting off his ear. Because why is he cutting off his ear? Because he's going, wait, the Messiah, this is the Messiah. Is this time for battle? Is this what we're doing now? Let's do it. Let's bring the armies. Let's bring the victory. Let's break the yoke. Let's be the ones that handle this. Take them out. They're going down now. Hi-ya! I don't know if he said hi-ya, but he probably thought about it. And then, what did Jesus say? Put away your sword! He says, those who use the sword will die by the sword. And again he says, don't you realize that I could ask my Father, I could ask God in heaven, for thousands of angels to protect us. And he would send them eventually once he gets the memo and we'll get around to it. And eventually, you know, it might be a little later. No, instantly. He says, Peter, followers, guys, don't you get it? I'm not doing this accidentally. I'm not falling into their power and I can't handle it. I could instantly ask my Father in heaven and he would, boom, we win. It's over. It's done. He says, but if I did, how would the scriptures be fulfilled that describe what must happen now? Translation, Jesus is saying, if we won right now, you would all lose eternally. If we win this battle now and I don't go to the cross, you're going to hell for eternity. We're today in 2025 going to hell for eternity if Peter and the other disciples got their way. So that's the flashback. That is what's bringing us into where we're about to read in this next verse. Because even this point, Jesus is crucified, but I believe, this is just kind of my assumption here looking at the story, I think they still were expecting him to jump down off the cross and be like, I'm getting ready to die. Just kidding. Zap, 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 zap. We win. I think they were expecting that. That there was going to be this great victory. And so that's the flashback. Those are the verses that are there. Next slide. Which then brings us back to the foreshadowing. The foreshadowing from John chapter 19, verses 26 to 27. So we're at the foot of the cross. Four soldiers, four women. In verse 26, it says, when Jesus saw his mother standing there beside the disciple he loved. Who's the disciple he loved? John, right. So Jesus saw Mary standing next to John. He said to her, to Mary, dear woman, here is your son. And he said to this disciple, to John, here is your mother. And it says, and from then on, this disciple took her into his home. And I think this was the moment that John was asked to care for Jesus' mom. You need to take over for me. You need to take care of her. As I said in the creative team meeting, we were discussing this. I think for John, crap just got real. Because, wait, what? Wait, you're not going to ask me to care for your mom if... What? Are you actually going to die? I'll be glad to care for her. But you're supposed to win. You're supposed to conquer. You're supposed to break their back. This isn't how it was supposed to be. And John realized that, wait, this is for real. This is the plan. And he still doesn't quite get it, and we'll get to next week when he's really going to get it. But just this whole idea of John recognizing and this foreshadowing that something, wait, Jesus, you're, by doing this, you're foreshadowing. You know what that means? You're telling me that you're going to die. Next slide. So with this foreshadowing, what we see with the point is that John saw that Jesus planned to die. Do you get that now? Like, for us, we're like, we know. But for John, he's like, oh, yeah, no, you're not really going to die because we know what the Messiah is supposed to do. We know you're not going to do that. We know you're going to conquer. We know you're going to win. We know you're not going to go to this cross. Okay, you're on the cross now. But we know that you're going to be like, and, you know, like a big, and do like, I don't know, some kind of superhero thing. And you come down. That was like the power game. You see the, and yeah, okay. And John was like, no, wait, Jesus actually planned to die. And I think in that moment, John realized something. John realized that Jesus' way is submissive, is surrender. Jesus was hands up, not to the people, but to the will of his Father. And he was willing to go through all the agony, all the humiliation, all the pain of the cross because he was willing to submit to what his Father had for him, which we know was because he had our hearts, our eternity in mind. Because on our own, because of our sin, because of our sin, we are going to hell. We are on our way. We have been on our way from birth. No one had to teach us how to sin. And sin separates us from God. So we're going to hell. We did a whole series called Burn a number of years ago. You can find out more about that. We're on our way. And if Jesus is like, I'm going to win and beat the Romans down, we are still going there. But God stepped in, and this is not on the screen. It says, when the fullness of time, at just the right time, Galatians says, God sent his son, born under the law, to redeem people, to rescue people. And he did that for us. And so when Jesus had the authority, had the power, had the ability to come off the cross, he said, no, this is a stick up. This is me surrendering. Because I love you so much. I'm surrendering to the will of the Father. And in Philippians, Paul records it this way as he wrote this letter to the church in Philippi. In verses 5 to 8, Paul says, you must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. What is that attitude? Well, Paul says, though he was God, Jesus fully God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. So we are supposed to have an attitude like Jesus. He was fully God. He had every right to say, no, I'm God, I'm not going. And you know what? If you're going to hell, that's your own problem. And if we want to be literal, that's your own damned problem because you're damned to hell. But that's not what he did because he loves us. And so instead of clinging to what he deserved, instead he gave up his divine privileges. And he took the humble position of a slave or a servant and was born as a human being. He came down because of us. And when he appeared in human form, he then went even further. He humbled himself in obedience to God, in surrender to God, and died a criminal's death on a cross. And that's supposed to be our attitude. And that's the attitude that Jesus had. He said, I'm surrendering to the will of my Father. I'm giving up what I deserve because I love humanity, because I love people, because I love you. And so Jesus' way is submissive. And Paul says we should have that same attitude. And that was Philippians 2, 5 to 8. But because Jesus' way is submissive, I want to just kind of turn this a corner a little bit and say, what does that mean for us? If we're supposed to have an attitude like Jesus who submitted, who surrendered, what does that mean for us? And I got three things here in kind of broad categories, and I am definitely going to fly through these verses, Luke. I told you ahead of time. So the first thing, if Jesus' way was submissive, that means for us, so we should submit to each other. If we're supposed to have his attitude and do things the way he did, it means I need to submit to you and you need to submit to me. And we need to do that out of love. And in Ephesians chapter 5, and we've got a whole bunch of verses there, we're not looking at all of them. But in Ephesians 5:21, Paul starts that section in Ephesians with this. And further submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. So back up. There we go. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so what Paul is saying here is if we love Jesus and we recognize his attitude and the way he did things, then we need to say, you know what, I deserve things. And you know what, I'm right actually in this case of this argument. I actually am right. The facts point to the fact that I'm right. But Paul says maybe being right isn't right. Maybe winning isn't the way. Maybe victory isn't always the thing. Maybe we need to say, you know what? I'm giving this up because I care about you. And I can't tell you this story publicly, but something happened over the last couple of weeks here at MC3 with Chris. And that sounds really bad. A really cool God moment. But if I share it publicly, it would be embarrassing to this person. But it was definitely a moment where we're like, you know what? Let me tell you about what we deserve. And if we had stuck to our rights, this really cool God moment would not have happened. And so that idea is that we need to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then Paul goes on, and now we'll go a little faster. And he says, in this whole section of Ephesians 5 through 6, he says, well, whoa, got caught on my spur there. Whew, almost died. Okay. He says, for wives, this means submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And we talked about all these in the Familying series. And you're like, what does that mean? I'm my husband's slave? No. It doesn't, okay? But he's just kind of sharing. What does submitting to one another mean? So for wives, it means submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For husbands, this means, next slide. This means love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. He gave himself up for her. So how, wives, do you submit to your husbands? Husbands, do you submit to your wives as well by loving her the way Christ loved the church? He goes on and says, children, obey your parents. This is the way you submit to one another. You submit by obeying your parents because you belong to the Lord, and this is the right thing to do. But then he says, fathers, and you could say parents, do not provoke your children to anger by the way you treat them. So parents, submit to your kids. You could show your authority and prove it, but maybe there's moments where you hold back because you love your kids, because you're showing the attitude of Christ. He goes on and says, slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. And again, this is an idea of if you're working for someone, work well. And we'll get to that in a second. And then he goes on to the other side and says, okay, masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Submit to your people. Submit to the people that work for you. Treat them in the same way. Don't threaten them. Remember, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites. And then over in 1 Peter, and I don't have time to read this whole passage, but it's really wild. Peter talks about, next slide there, he talks about how we are, that leaders, the elders in the church, are to submit to the people and serve them with love. And he says, not lording it over them, but being examples to the flock. And then he goes on in the next slide there and says, in the same way, you or her younger, submit yourselves to your elders. Like there are spiritual advisors, spiritual leaders, spiritual guides in your life. Submit to them. Don't be like, I'm young and I know more. And you probably do, but trust something about that maturity there. But then he says, all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. Why? Because God opposes the proud. Do you want God against you? Just be arrogant. Just get your rights. Get your way. See how that works for you. But shows favor to the humble. He says, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. And so this idea of submitting to one another, to each other, like there's a lot, like we could win. We could say we get this. We have the rights. We deserve this. But if we're going to have the attitude of Christ who is submissive, we maybe need to submit to each other. Maybe there's a moment where you need to submit to someone else. The second thing is, if Jesus' way is submissive, so we should submit to authority. And I'm going to fly through this too, but in both of these verses, by the way, if you want to just look at, take a picture, write them down, Romans 13, 1 to 7, 1 Peter 2, 13 to 25, Paul starts out in Romans chapter 13, verse 1, he says, everyone must submit to governing authorities. And he goes on and says, why? Because everyone in charge is them, put there by God. And they're serving God. And even if you don't like them and they don't like you, God still is in control of the whole thing. And he goes on and says, they're God's servants. Next slide. Sent for your good. He says, you do the right thing. He even says, by the way, coming up on Tuesday, pay your taxes too. For these same reasons, your government workers need to be paid. They are serving God and what they do. And you can be like, well, that's not really fair. And they're not really doing a good job with my money. And I don't think taxes are right. I don't care. You could say what you deserve, but if we're supposed to submit as Christ submits, maybe we should submit to the authorities over us. He says, give respect and honor to those who are in authority. And then over in 1 Peter 2, he says the same kind of thing. Respect the king, submit in authority, submit to the people in charge of you. Go to the next, one more after that, Luke, for me. One more. He says, for Christ call you to do good, even if it means suffering, just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps. And so it's all tied to that idea of submitting to authority. And that authority might be the government. It might be the man. It might be your boss that you really don't like, and no one else likes them either. It might be a teacher. It might be a speed limit sign. I don't know. Sorry, I don't want to get too personal. But if we're supposed to have an attitude like Jesus has, instead I'm submitting, instead of saying, no, I know better than this person, maybe we should have his attitude. And then the third thing, and this is really where it matters and it lands, and we're going to go a few minutes late. Because Jesus' way is submissive, so we should submit to God. And this is what I said earlier, we're going to come back to. So after the Last Supper, before he was arrested, Jesus was out in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives, and he was praying. And we have this recorded in Luke chapter 22. Says Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, pray that you will not fall into temptation. Then it says, he withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed. And this is what he prayed. Because within hours, he is going to be beaten and nailed to the cross. He's going to be ripped. His flesh is going to be ripped from his back. He's going to be spit upon. He's going to be mocked. He's going to have a crown of thorns pressed down where the thorns stick into his skull. And then he's going to be nailed through his hands and his feet. And going to have to pull up against that to just breathe. And so, being fully man and fully God, because he can experience every human feeling and emotion that we had, he says, Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me. One of the other Gospels records him saying, God, you can do anything. So if there's any other way, if there's any other way, because this is going to be, ready? Excruciating. Latin word, out of the cross. Ex, out of, cruciating, cross, crucifix. It is excruciating. That's where we get that term. He says, it's going to be awful. So if there's any other way, please. But what does he say? Yet. Other translations say, nevertheless, no matter, not my will, but yours be done. And then it said an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. And that's actually a clinical condition that can happen too. Because Jesus really, from a human perspective, did not want to do what he was about to do. And he says, God, if there's any way. But Jesus' way wasn't, no, God, I deserve, and so I'm not doing this. His way was hands up, surrender. Not my will, but yours be done. And even if you've never been to church before, if you're watching online, it's the first time you've ever been, you know, connected to a church, you're probably familiar with this over in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus says, pray like this. Our Father in heaven, may your name be kept holy. May your kingdom come soon. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And what we've got here is the prayer that Jesus tells us to pray. He says, God, my prayer is, I want your will, not mine. Our prayer should be the same as Jesus, saying, yeah, I know what I want. I know what I deserve. But I want what you want because your way is better. And sometimes, you know, if you're getting robbed at gunpoint, you probably deserve to keep the money that you have. But maybe that 10 bucks and the Blockbuster card, right? You got a Blockbuster card in your wallet? Anyway, if you know what that means, you're laughing. If you don't, that's it. Anyway, but maybe that's not worth your life. And it's the same thing when it comes to submitting to God's will. Say, God, I surrender. You know what? I think I know what's best, but you know what's better. And even though what I want kind of, like, I would rather not go to the cross, but if that's what it takes, then I surrender. I submit. Hands up. God, take what you want. And so Jesus' way is submissive. So we should submit to each other. And maybe that's what you need to do. You need to submit. Maybe there's something God's saying, you know what, there's a person, there's a family member, there's a relationship that you need to give up your rights. It's not because you're a loser. It's because you're submitting and saying, God, I'm trusting you in this. Maybe there's an authority figure that you need to submit to. And maybe you just need to submit to God. Because when John saw that Jesus planned to die, he realized that Jesus was surrendering. Jesus was submitting. And so we're doing this thing each week called Through My Eyes, because we were looking through John's eyes. But each of you have around you, go to the next thing there, Luke. Each of you should have a card around you on the seat, in front of you, around you. If you don't have a card, get one. And there's kind of some pens, but they probably don't work anyway. But if you don't have a card, Dawn has a couple extras. There's some around you that you can get. But I want everybody to have one. And we're just going to kind of look at what is God saying to you? What does this look like through your eyes? And the card says this. It says, Jesus' way is submissive. And he is calling me to submit to blank. And as we did last week, I want you just to take a moment with God. Can we turn off the main light room here, Tommy? And just reflect, who is it that God is telling you to submit to? Again, maybe that's a family. Maybe that's a follower of Jesus. Maybe it's an authority. Maybe it's just God himself. And write that down. Do you have him? And then write that down. And then what we're going to do, as we did last week, is once you're ready, once you know it is, it's anonymous. Don't write your name on there. You're just going to go out to the lobby and clip it on one of the paper clips. This is an act of prayer, an act of surrender, an act of submission. And so take a few moments to do that. While Jack plays, I'm going to be silent, give you a few minutes, Who is it that God is calling you to submit to? And once you know who that is, once you've got what God wants you to do, just quietly get up and make that a prayer as you clip it to the wall. God, this is my prayer. Help me to surrender. Help me to submit to that person.